May it please the court, my name is Tiffany Schrank. I'm here on behalf of the appellants, Linda Rogers, Frederick Rogers, and Roger Ellerby Sr. The appellants in this case filed a wrongful death action against the Christina School District, superintendent of the school district, the principal of Newark High School, and the behavioral interventionist at Newark High School, Margaret Finney. The wrongful death action claimed gross negligence on the part of the school and the behavior interventionist in their failure to properly respond to the suicide threats of 16-year-old Roger Ellerby Jr., who was known by the nickname Mac. Mac's death was a preventable death, and I will tell you the facts of Mac's death as follows. On Sunday, Mac attempted suicide at home. No one was aware of this failed suicide attempt until Monday, when Mac went to school. Mac attended school at Newark High School, and there he told two of his friends that he had attempted suicide and that he intended to kill himself. These two friends were concerned about their friend, and they approached the biology teacher at school. They informed the biology teacher of Mac's attempted suicide and that they were concerned for a friend. Thereafter, the biology teacher the next morning informed the behavioral interventionist of the situation concerning a student who wanted to kill himself. The behavioral interventionist is a type of school counselor at Newark High School. Her name was Margaret Finney. She called Mac into her office that Tuesday morning, and she met with him for several hours. While she met with him, Mac admitted to being suicidal. He admitted to attempting suicide. She met with him for several hours, and then she released him. She released him to return to his school day. She did not call his parents, and she did not call the police. Mac finished out his school day that day, and then after class, he went home, and he went into his basement, and he committed suicide. Now, there were protocols in place within the school district. Those protocols, one in particular, called the Crisis Intervention for Suicide Threats Protocol, required that the counselor who is aware of a student's suicide threat stay with the student and contact the parent. In this situation, the counselor did neither of those things. She just let the student go back to his class, and she did not attempt to contact the parents.
Now, are those protocols similar in all the school districts?
I'm not aware if they're similar in all the school districts, but they are throughout the Christina School District, which is the defendant in this case.
But are they adopted pursuant to DOE authority?
Well, there is also a Department of Education protocol, which can be found on their website, and that is the same procedure, and that is to contact the parents or guardians immediately when you're aware of a student's risk of harm to himself or others, and if you cannot contact the parent, then to call the police.
Have you filled in your recitation of the facts all the events that occurred during the consultation that day?
The main facts, yes. She was also...
Your recitation of the facts suggests to me, at least, that there was no information conveyed that the originally perceived threat may not have been as serious at the end of the day as when the consultation began. Were there any facts to suggest that perhaps the threat had dissipated to some degree by the time the student left?
When he left, the behavioral interventionist described him as smiling. So if that was something to her that alleviated a harm...
That's it?
That was it.
I thought there was some kind of writing that the behavioral interventionist asked him to produce both at the beginning of the session and at the end, and that what he wrote at the end was, I know people love me now and things aren't as bad. Something along those lines.
Yes, there was one note she asked Roger to write. In that note, he began by saying how he was feeling alone and he wanted to hurt himself and others. At the end of the note, he did kind of say that he was grateful and that he was appreciating that he was loved.
And am I imagining the fact that his girlfriend came in and he heard her discuss his situation and there was some additional information that came to the attention of the behavioral consultant?
By way of additional information, I'm not sure what you mean. The girlfriend was called in. Originally, when Mac was called into the office, his friend Anya Walker was with the counselor. Mm-hmm. She stayed for quite a while. Ms. Walker had a past suicide attempt, and she was the one who brought it to the biology teacher's knowledge that she had a friend that she was concerned about. So she took it very seriously. When she was in the presence of the counselor and Mac, she spoke to Mac openly about him, what he had told her about him attempting suicide and wanting to attempt to kill himself again. She took it very seriously. At some point in the conversation, the girlfriend did come up in this discussion, and at that point, the counselor stated that maybe we should bring the girlfriend into this discussion. At that point, Ms. Walker stated that she would return to class, and the girlfriend was brought in, and she met with Mac and the counselor.
You didn't think any of that was important when you were reciting the facts to us?
I don't believe that changes anything in terms of the risk of threat that was known and the fact that she met with him for several hours and that he admitted to being suicidal. Okay. The fact that there were witnesses who were there and present who heard him admit to the counselor that he was suicidal, that he had attempted suicide, yes, that is a fact in our favor. The girlfriend,
well, as I understood your point, it was that they had an obligation to contact the parents initially, and notwithstanding the fact that they met with him, they had a continuing duty to let the parents know of the situation.
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. They had a continuing duty. They were required to follow the protocol. He admitted to being a risk to himself. In his note, he also stated that he wanted to hurt others. So,
excuse me, am I correct that there were two notes?
No, there was one note.
All right, does the one note have two parts to it, one part having been written at the beginning of the session and the other part at the end?
I believe that's in the defendant's factual scenario. The appellants contend that there was one note written and it was written at the end of the session.
When you say duty to notify the parents or guardian, because here they were grandparents, right?
Correct. Mac was living with his paternal grandparents. He had been living with them and in their care since he was 2 weeks old.
But they were legal guardians?
I don't believe there was ever a family court order establishing them as guardians.
Were they on record with the school as persons to contact?
Yes, they were. They were listed as his guardians in his file that was maintained by Newark High School.
Just so I understand, you're saying that the duty of the defendants was, number one, not to release this child until a guardian could take him home, and secondly, they didn't contact the parents who were the guardians.
Correct.
Then both of those were a breach of a duty.
Correct. Those are breaches of the duty. The duty is a duty of protection that is owed to him when they know that there is...
I have two questions. Okay. Number one, is there any issue in the case as to whether or not, even if those duties had been complied with, it would have changed the outcome? That's the first question. The second question is, what's the source of the duty? That is the source anything other than the protocol that you just alluded to?
To answer your first question, whether or not there would be a change in the outcome if they had complied with their duty, that's not known. There is the evidence that Anya Walker had a past suicide attempt. She had obtained professional counseling, and she...
Well, we're talking about proximate cause. Was there a proximate cause defense raised at this stage?
No, there was not, Your Honor.
All right.
And then to answer your question about the genesis or the basis for the duty, the appellants contend that there are several bases from which this duty arises. One is the doctrine of in loco parentis. The other one would be the conduct of the defendants themselves. They had enacted protocols. They had hired counselors and psychologists within the school to counsel students on emotional and social needs. There's also restatement sections that the appellants have relied upon. That would be 314A and 323, which were briefed both in the lower court and in this court, that we state support.
What is the lead authority that you rely upon? Is it Sammons or is it something else?
The lead authority in our case, we've contended that FURIC provides both for the in loco parentis doctrine and the application of Section 323. Also, Section 314, the illustration, is an illustration in which a student goes to school and is known to be in danger. He has a fever. It progresses throughout the day. In that illustration, it's the school who is liable for the aggravation of his injuries because they failed to provide medical treatment to him.
You were interrupted before you finished the first part of your answer earlier. You were describing, at least as I understood it, the circumstances that would trigger the requirement to notify, in this case, the grandmother under the protocol. And I had the impression that you were going to state that when it rose to a level where there was an assessment that there was a continuing threat of suicide.
Our contention is that when there's an immediate risk of irreparable harm, or when it's known that the child is a foreseeable risk of harm to himself or others, in that situation, that is a situation by definition of the Department of Education protocols. In that situation, it would trigger the protocol and trigger the need to call the parent.
Well, that's why I asked you the question earlier when you recited the facts to us, whether the facts were as harsh as you described them or whether there was arguably a dissipation of the risk or the foreseeability of harm by the time the counseling was over. In other words, somebody is reported to be suicidal. They admit that they attempted suicide the day before. At the end of the consultation, let's call it, for lack of a better term, is there any issue about the extent to which the facts demonstrate a dissipation in that risk that would mean there's no longer a triggering of the need to warn the guardian?
In my opinion, and in the appellant's contention, is that no, there is no dissipation of facts in this case. And that is because the counselor in this situation had no training or education in adolescent depression, adolescent psychology, in the warning signs to be aware of when looking for see if the student's depressed or suicidal. If she had been in a situation where she was educated and properly trained to look for those distinctions, I think there would still be a need to call the parent. You still need to follow the protocol. And even if the student had said, no, I think I'm fine, he's still admitting that he was suicidal. He had already attempted suicide. And just a matter of hours earlier had stated that he was still intending to kill himself.
Just so I understand, that you're basically suggesting there is no dissipation issue here. Counseling can't cure the danger. The end of the day session has no ameliorative effect. If the child admits the day before he attempted suicide, if he in the initial conversation indicates he had suicidal tendencies, that triggers the obligation, and nothing that follows has any impact on that obligation under the protocol. Is that your position?
Yes, that's our position.
Okay.
And the way I read your brief there, if you want to make an analogy, it's like someone has a concussion, and they say, we think you're okay, go home, but watch for this or that. I understood your argument to be that when the protocol is triggered by the suicide, you need to contact the parent. If you interact with the student, even if you think the situation is under control, you have a duty to tell the parent that the situation occurred so that the parent can monitor the child.
Yes, that's correct. So this situation where we're dealing with minors, and your analogy with the concussion syndrome, that's a physical ailment, something that you can watch for physical symptoms of. And in this type of situation where there's a mental illness, the parent may not be knowing what is going on with the child. In this situation, the parents did not know that their child was suicidal or depressed. They had no warning signs. And if they were brought to their attention that it was reported that the child is suicidal and had a past suicide attempt, then they're on notice. They can properly watch the child and see what attention he needs. And they can also ensure that he gets the proper professional treatment that he needs.
To follow up on Justice Holland's question, I understand, and tell me if this is correct or not, that the duty that you claimed existed here comes from one of two sources, two possible sources, either the protocol, because which would be negligence per se, because the protocol dictated what should have been done here, or based simply based on the common law principle that a reasonably prudent person in Ms. Feeney's position would have done you know, what you claim should have been done. Is there any other source of the duty besides those two?
No, our main contention is that there's a special relationship, and as I said, that in loco parentis doctrine and the restatement sections support that there is a special relationship between the school and the minor child to create that duty.
But those are doctrines that independently support the common law principle, is that correct?
That is correct.
There's sort of subheadings under it.
Yes. And in this situation, since there was an intervention done, albeit a negligent intervention by the counselor, then we can say that there was conduct that can be found negligent, and she would be owed a duty of reasonable care in that situation where she does step in and to attempt to counsel a child, but she has no training, education, she doesn't have the warning signs, she, and all.
Well, what's the standard of care that applies to her then? You're not going to impose upon her the standard of care that would apply to a psychiatrist or someone who was appropriately trained, as you believe they ought to have been. Is it the school district's fault for not having a psychiatrist or a well-trained person on duty to talk to the student?
Actually, there was a psychologist on duty that same day. And in this situation, if the counselor that he was referred to, that Mac was referred to, wasn't prepared and capable of handling this situation, she should have referred it to the psychologist. But she should have also, she was
so
one person.
That's the third thing she should have done, huh?
I'm sorry?
That's the third thing she should have done and didn't do.
Correct. She should have referred it to the psychologist.
Well, just let me be clear on this. There's a protocol that says if a child expresses some suicidal thoughts or attempts suicide, that the school must stay with the child and contact the parent and or the guardian. And if that's not, if that doesn't work, if the parent or guardian's unavailable, the school must call the police to follow up on the situation. Is that what you understand the protocol requires?
That's the protocol that is on the Department of Education website. That's referred to as a quick reference protocol for crisis situations, and that applies when a child is in risk of harming himself and others.
You agree that that's what the protocol says?
Yes.
Okay. And is it your contention that the interventionist knew that this was the protocol and was required, even if she thought that everything had been squared away, to follow those steps, that is, to stay with the child or have somebody else, at the, you know, a responsible member of the staff stay with the child and contact the parent or guardian?
It's our contention she should have known that, that the protocol was in place and she should have followed it. I'm aware that she has claimed that she was not aware of the protocol that was in place. Why they would have a person, a counselor, acting in crisis situations and not provide them with that protocol,
which
I can't answer.
Either the school district protocol or the DOE protocol or both. What was her obligation, in your view?
Well, if the DOE protocol is required of the districts, then the DOE protocol would be the primary protocol to follow. They are very similar. They both require that the person stay with the child and contact the parents immediately. The district protocol has an additional...
So for purposes of this case, they're the same then?
I would say that they're the same, yes, Your Honor. Just in terms of the requirements that they contact the parents, if they can't contact the parents, contact the police, don't let the child out of your care. The district protocol, that if you look at, it's in the appellant's appendix to the opening brief, that I believe it's A-172 through 178, has an additional step of doing a report and following up within a couple of weeks on the child. that is not in the DOE protocol, but the main steps of staying with the child, notifying the parent, those are in this, both in this protocol of the district and the DOE protocol.
Did you want to save the balance of your time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right.
May it please the court, Mark Castorino of White and Williams, LLP, on behalf of Christina School District, Dr. Marshall Isles, and Curtis Bedford. I'm also accompanied at council table by Gilbert Shelby on behalf of Marjette Finney and Holistic Family Services. I'm going to take the lead in presenting the appellee's argument today on behalf of the appellees.
Is it clear that the issue in this case is the existence or non-existence of a duty, or is there some other issue as well?
Well, Your Honor, I believe there are a number of issues and defenses that have, you know, not yet been presented even to the trial court. Of course,
I'm talking about issues that are before us.
Oh, before you. I apologize, Your Honor. It's the issue of whether there was a legal duty or not.
That's the issue.
That is the issue before the court.
That's the basis of the Superior Court's dismissal, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. Your Honors, I'm entirely sympathetic that a 16-year-old took his own life here, and that is certainly a sad situation. However, when this court comes to consider whether to impose a broad legal duty upon the public school system vis-a-vis its students, that broad duty and the contours of it cannot be molded upon sympathy or moral outrage over a particular incident.
Why is it such a broad duty? If all you have to do is upon being made aware of a problem like this, not even that you have to have people who are looking for symptoms of children who are about to commit suicide, but when you are made aware of it, all you have to do is stay with the student and contact the parents, and if you can't reach the parents, contact the police. What's so broad about that duty?
Because, Your Honor, as you know, the facts of this case may be relatively focused, but of course the ruling is going to be that the school has a duty with respect to its students that is going to go beyond the scope of this case.
Why would that be the case? Justice Berger just very succinctly identified the scope of the duty, and wouldn't we be looking at the school district or the DOE's protocol and say this is similar to Sammons versus Ridgeway, when there are guidelines for conduct of a school bus driver operating a school bus? You fail to follow those regulations, you're guilty of negligence per se. Here's a protocol, tells you what to do under these circumstances, tells you exactly what to do. What's complicated about this?
It's complicated by some of the very questions that Your Honor's asked of appellant's counsel in terms of dissipation of the risk and things of that nature, because there are a number
of... factual. Whether or not there's proximate cause, whether or not it was a correct assessment at the end of the day to follow through, or whether the potential for further suicidal expression of suicidal tendencies existed or not, is arguably a factual question. But all we're dealing with here is, does the protocol create a duty, or does some other basis for a duty exist beyond the protocol that would have required the school district to follow exactly what Justice Berger just described?
We believe the answer is no, and I'll explain why. We don't believe this protocol establishes a legal duty, and nor should it under any circumstances. This is not like the protocol that was involved in the Sammons case. This is more akin to the protocol in the Joseph v. Monroe case that we discussed.
Your point, I gather, is that to the extent the protocol has any relevance, it's not as a source of a duty because the protocol did not have the force of law. It wasn't an administrative regulation, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
But even if that's the case, why doesn't the protocol inform the existence or non-existence of a common law duty?
Well, it could very well be part of the mix that goes into the recipe of the court's consideration. However, for the reasons we've set forth in our briefing and I'll articulate today, we don't believe there is a common law duty.
There's always a common law duty that would apply to someone in the position of Pasquini to do what a reasonable person would do in the circumstances. And the argument would be that the protocol, you know, basically explains, or it certainly is evidentiary of what a reasonable person should do in the circumstances.
I understand, Your Honor.
And what is your response to the argument?
Our response is that we don't necessarily agree that there is this broad, general, common law duty under all circumstances. As this court set forth in the Rydell case, the fact that an actor realizes or should realize that action on his part is necessary for another's aid or protection does not itself impose upon him a duty to take such action. And that is the general law, that there is no duty to act unless there is some exception, as appellants argue under the restatement. And, of course, our counterargument is that those restatement sections are not applicable.
Suppose a child said, well, you know, thank you for your time and attention, but I'm going to go home and commit suicide. Would that matter? Under your principle, there would be no liability, even if that happened.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor, and we could come up with a number of hypotheticals and egregious fact patterns. But again, as I stated from the outset, that does not guide the moral outrage or sympathy factor does not guide whether to create a legal duty.
What about the proposition that even if you don't have a duty, if you decide to act, you have to do it in a way that's not negligent? And the theory in this case is that, assuming you're right and you had no duty, the record reflects that an untrained person spent several hours with this child and let them go home and perhaps didn't render the correct professional advice or judgment.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that it was voluntarily undertaken, which is a necessary element. And in fact, I wrote down a quote that appellant's counsel said in response to the court's...
What was not voluntarily undertaken?
Any interaction with a student or the enactment of the protocols and the interaction with the student pursuant to these protocols. And for the very reason, as appellant's counsel said, the DOE protocol is required of the school district.
So it's mandatory
by the Department of Education. So it's not voluntarily undertaken, which is an essential element.
Was it lawful for DOE to do that?
Yes, in the sense that the legislature, as we point out in our briefing, offered a very broad grant to the DOE to...
Let me ask you a question so I don't continue to be confused. Your position is, in this particular case, the counselor interacted with the student because of the DOE protocol. Nevertheless, the DOE protocol doesn't impose a duty.
Correct. And the explanation for that is and again, in response to Your Honor's question as well, the directive to the DOE pursuant to 14 Del Code Section 122 Subpart B2 is to have guidelines generically addressing the physical inspection of and the protection of the health and physical welfare of public school students.
Mr. Cancerino, is it your position that there are no circumstances under which a counselor, as an employee of a school district, could be held liable if there were serious objective indications that the child that she was counseling was going to commit suicide?
If I may, in response to your question, first of all, Ms. Finney was not an employee of the school district. She's an independent contractor. I didn't want that to go unsaid.
As corrected.
Understood. Again, I'm sure we could come up with a number of hypothetical circumstances which would be not necessarily the facts of this case where a duty could be imposed. But we're here with this case on the facts and circumstances of this case.
I understand, but the principle that you're relying on suggests that there is no set of circumstances under which someone in the position of Ms. Feeney or her or the school district could be held liable?
There's none under current Delaware law, and if there is to be this change, we believe it should come from the legislature, much like the Maryland legislature acted in that state. Here, Delaware has not acted that way.
That's not this case, definitely not this case. If the student had said to a classmate, when I go home tonight, I'm going to kill my next-door neighbor, and the classmate goes to the school authorities and says, you know, my classmate says when he goes home tonight, he's going to kill the next-door neighbor, does the school have any duty to do anything?
In that circumstances, actually, there may be other statutory predicates for mandatory reporting obligations in terms of student violence.
If you kill your next-door neighbor, maybe the school has a duty, but if you're going to kill yourself, the school has no duty.
Not under the current state of the law. That's correct, Your Honor. Well, and again, that, if there is to be that change or that imposition of a duty, it should come from the legislature.
I want to explore your concept of mandatory versus voluntary. And let me take a page out of Justice Holland's book and for the first time in 12 years give you a hypothetical for me. I'm a crossing guard. School district says when you cross from our property across the street for whatever purpose, to walk home or catch a school bus, we have to have a crossing guard there. The crossing guard is there, and the crossing guard makes a mistake of judgment and sends a child across before it's safe to do so. Is there no basis for liability because it was mandatory that there be a crossing guard? They didn't voluntarily decide to send the child across at the wrong time, and therefore no liability? And if that's not analogous to the situation you've posited, why isn't it?
Your Honor, I don't know enough about what, you know, statutory requirements there are for crossing guards and their standard of care.
Well, let's assume it's a protocol from DOE or from the school district that says, in order for our students to cross the street, we provide a crossing guard for their safety. What's the difference? Why is mandatory versus voluntary relevant at all?
Well, it's relevant under the restatement second, which is the law in Delaware for torts. And that provides that there is no common law duty unless it is a voluntary undertaking, because here they're taking the student, as appellants say, under their protection and counseling him. And there is no duty owed there unless they've done so in a voluntary manner. And here the protocols require them to engage with this student, as the appellants say, to follow certain prescribed steps. We don't necessarily agree with that, but that's their argument. And our position is, in response to that argument, that those are mandated, much like the statutory requirements were mandated in the Bradley case that Judge Leis wrote about. And those do not constitute a voluntary act. Those are pursuant to law.
Can I see if I understand you? The existing protocol by the DOE does not have the effect of law, and therefore it does not impose a duty.
Correct.
But that same protocol requires that certain conduct be undertaken, and therefore when the interventionist acted the way she did, she was not doing it voluntarily and therefore had no duty because it was not a voluntary act. Is that the gist of it?
That is the gist of it.
You don't see where you're trying to use the same thing in two different ways?
No, Your Honor, because, again, there's a claim against the school district, and the claim is that the school district had these protocols and that created some duty by the school district vis-a-vis the student. And our position is that is not the case, that these were not voluntarily enacted. These were mandated by the Department of Education due to their requirements. And so that lack of voluntary action does not create a common law duty under the restatement sections that the appellants are relying upon.
Well, what kind of duty is it when the DOE mandates something? Can they write them back and say, no, we don't like that, we're not going to do that? Is there a consequence?
I suppose there would be some sort of consequence, and I'm speculating now that it would probably be some sort of financial penalty or other licensing penalty. I don't know. But I'm sure there was some consequence to telling them no. But again, just along the same line of thought, as again, Judge Schlitz points out in the Bradley decision, the performance of a statutory mandate alone cannot reasonably be characterized as gratuitous within the parameters of Section 323 of the Restatement Second of Torts, which is what appellants rely upon. So even if we have these protocols, again, just this is just a gratuitous, or not a gratuitous, it's not gratuitous because they've been imposed on them by the Department of Education.
But if a student falls down in the school building, you know, breaks their arm and the bones protruding through the flesh, so you don't have to guess the arm's broken. Does the school have any duty to deal with the broken arm?
I believe it would. And the derivation of that would be from a premises liability aspect.
So the school has a duty to deal with a broken arm, but not a mental condition that rises to the level of being suicidal. So we're talking about a couple of different health conditions, one of which is physical, one is mental. And tell me the distinction when you're having these two serious health conditions where the arm, broken arm, imposes a duty, but the suicidal inclination does not.
Because as appellant's counsel pointed out, broken arm, as you've described, is open and obvious to most people of reasonable observation, whereas mental health triggers are not necessarily readily apparent to everyone. And so what is being asked of the public school, which is in the business of educating, teaching, reading, writing, and arithmetic, is to act as mental health professionals now. And
they're not asking, as I understand it, the DOE said, call the parents.
And what's more, if I understand it correctly, there's no obligation to go class by class and screen all the students and make a decision as to whether they are potentially suicidal. This is something that was brought to the school's attention as being an actual case of someone who had attempted suicide. How can you say that this is an enormous burden?
It is an enormous burden, and I'm not suggesting that they need to canvass students every day, but as you can imagine, in a high school, a large high school, the large student population, things are heard or said constantly. And so to put a duty on school personnel to digest them, analyze them, much like a mental health professional would, and consider whether what I just heard passing in the hallway, does that trigger me to now have to go and do something in terms of contacting authorities or taking this child into custody? That's the broad duty. Well, exactly, and that's the broad duty that is being asked to be imposed, and that's why it's a broad duty. It's not so confined as everyone would like to think.
If there's a protocol both from DOE and from the school district that addresses that question, even if it's in a limited fact situation as we have here, why isn't that the answer to your question?
Because
DOE and the school district have determined that they should undertake that obligation.
I don't necessarily agree that the school district agreed. It was, again, this is not a gratuitous undertaking, as we've said.
What was the basis for not following either protocol in this case?
Well, that requires a little bit of unwinding, and I'm not going to get into a line-by-line as to the factual recitation. We don't necessarily agree with it. But one thing I do want to correct before the train goes too much further down the track is there's a statement that Ms. Finney didn't call anyone. That's inaccurate. Mac's parents, guardians, whomever, provided a contact list with numbers to the school, which is in the school's file, and includes four telephone numbers. We've established that two of those apparently are old numbers, old cell phone numbers. Linda Rogers, the grandmother, had no recollection of what those numbers were. The third number is apparently the Rogers home telephone number. And the fourth number is apparently an old number of Linda Rogers' previous place of employment. Ms. Finney tells us that she went and did attempt to call and did, in fact, call these four numbers. Of course, the first two were disconnected, and no one disagrees about that. The second was apparently the home phone number. She said, just rang and rang, and no one answered, and there was no answering machine. She called the fourth number. It rang. An answering machine picked up. It didn't give any indication to her that it was an improper number or no longer in service or anything, and she left a message for Linda Rogers on that number.
And what does the protocol say she should have done when she couldn't reach the guardians?
Well, she believes she did reach the guardians. She believes she left them a message telling them about the situation.
And then she stayed with him until the guardians who had gotten this message came to pick him up?
She did not. And getting back to the Chief Justice's line of questioning, that is because the situation in her estimation did not require that. And again, inherent in even these protocols is a subjective analysis. It requires some exercise of discretion. And so we do disagree with much of the facts.
But wouldn't those all be fact issues that a jury would ultimately decide on?
Well, yes, but whether there is a duty is a matter of law for the court to decide. And that's where we are here today.
How well she might have exercised her obligations, let's not call them duties, but her obligations under the protocol is for another day. What we need to determine is whether those obligations that were set forth in the DOE's regulations impose a duty on the school district.
Correct. Whether there was a duty either by those protocols or any other basis.
By the way, and if we get into whether or not this is a suggested protocol, mandatory or voluntary, as opposed to a regulation duly promulgated pursuant to a statute consistent with Sammons versus Ridgeway, if we get that far, is there an enforcement mechanism from DOE to be used against any school district that doesn't implement the protocol or develop a plan to address the protocol?
As I stand here today, I'm not aware of any, Your Honor, which gets back to part of the argument of why it is not negligence per se to not follow this
is
protocol.
Is it a best practices kind of standard, or is it something that the Department of Education cuts off funding if you don't comply with it, or similar to the way the feds work, you impose a mandate, don't send any money, and then fine you if you don't comply, or sends money and then takes the money away if you don't comply with it?
I'm not aware, as I stand here today, Your Honor, of any such penalty mechanism. I suppose there could be.
Does it result from some study that says that's what school districts and schools in this state ought to undertake to do for the protection of the children that are whose parents and others are paying significant taxes to fund school districts?
I'm not aware of any such. Again, that's not to say that.
So we just don't know what the origin of this protocol may have been.
Correct. Because it came from the Department of Education, not the school district. I don't know what the Department of Education's mechanism was for promulgating it.
Okay.
So, again, just to summarize as best I can, we do not believe that there is a just general common law duty under these circumstances, and the appellants have not, in our opinion, demonstrated that there is an exception to that, either under any of the applicable restatement sections that they've pursued. There's certainly not a broad general in loco parentis obligation here. I believe we've set forth in our papers the Delaware legislature has very carefully focused in loco parentis with respect to public schools to only disciplinary actions, which is certainly not the subject of this case, and it's not for us to expand that beyond the legislature's intended chosen language. So that is not a recourse for them either. We do not believe that the protocols constitute an enactment or a statute or anything of that nature that would have the force of law. There is no enforcement mechanism, as Chief Justice just pointed out.
Well, wait a second. I thought we don't know that.
Well, in terms of civil penalty for violating it, there's nothing in it that says, by the way, if you violate this, the student can sue you for X dollars or something like that.
That being the protocol?
That, correct.
And we know that the protocol does not include some other section of other protocols, perhaps, that says if you violate any of these protocols, the following will happen?
I don't believe that's the case.
But we don't have any knowledge about it.
It's not in the record before the court now.
Okay.
But I don't believe that to be the case. So again, while the moral implications of a failure to act in certain situations are compelling, particularly in cases involving children, Delaware courts have been careful to draw a bright line between a moral obligation to act, which will not necessarily subject a defendant to liability for failure to act, and a legal obligation or duty to act which may impose such obligation. There's good reason not to fuse those two concepts of moral obligation and legal duty to act. And that is, once one decides that as a matter of statutory or common law duty, an individual is required under some circumstances to act at his or her own cost for the exclusive benefit of another, then it's very hard to set out in a principled manner the limits of social interference with personal liberty. Even if the rule starts out with modest ambitions, it is difficult to confine it to those limits. And if we are going to expand it, the legislature should do so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd just like to begin by addressing appellee counsel's statement that the protocol is mandatory. If it's mandatory, then it was mandated by the Department of Education upon the school district, and that would come from a grant from the legislature giving the Department of Education the power to enact such a protocol and to require that the school districts follow that protocol.
Well, do we have any information as to whether there's some enforcement mechanism?
No, we have no indication whether or not there's enforcement mechanism. I mean, the consequences of failing to abide by the protocol could be, you know, discipline on the party who fails to follow the protocol, discipline on the...
Well, you're just making that up. You know, we don't know. There's
correct.
Nothing in the record. It could be set forth in bright letters in some document at the DOE, but we don't know about it.
That's correct. There's also two different protocols we're talking about here. There's the protocol of the Department of Education and also the protocol of the school district. Even if the protocol of the Department of Education, as they claim, is mandatory, they also enacted their own district protocol, which differs from the Department of Education protocol. Enacting that protocol is showing that they have responsibility for acting in this type of situation and responding to a crisis situation. That's acceptance of a duty.
But you're not claiming that either of those protocols has the force of law. Is that correct?
If they were mandated by the legislature, which it appears they were.
They weren't adopted by the legislature.
Well, I haven't seen or heard anything about the legislature mandating it. In fact, what we've heard is to the contrary, that the statutes don't create an in locus parentis relationship, and that this DOE protocol apparently just came out of whole cloth, out of thin air. Some bureaucrat in DOE decided this would be a touchy-feely good thing to implement and told all the school districts to do it. That's all we know.
Well, regarding the protocol, the appellants cite 14 Delaware Code Section 122, empowering the Department of Education to establish rules and regulations for controlling the health and welfare of minor students. We believe that's the basis for the enactment of the protocol.
Well, there's certain sanctity to the authority that devolves upon an agency to adopt a rule and regulation. There's a certain procedure that's required to adopt a rule or regulation, and many times, thankfully, there's opportunity for public comment. Is this protocol in the same category?
We're not aware of that, Your Honor. And also, in terms of in loco parentis,
how are we supposed to decide this case without knowing that?
This case turns on whether or not there's a duty. I think if we're trying to decide whether or not there's negligence per se, we can't say whether or not there's negligence per se because we don't know the actual effect of this Department of Education protocol. But there is enough in the record to support a common law duty here in this situation, either by special relationship between the school and its minor students or by the actual conduct of the defendants themselves in this situation.
I think we recognize that you're approaching it from multiple directions, and one's not dependent upon the other. It's just obvious, I think, that we're all intrigued about the existence of this protocol, what it really means in terms of how school districts are supposed to comply, and does it have the force of law or not? Is it just a best practices statement? What's the legal implication of it? We haven't lost sight of your common law argument or your argument under the restatement.
Right, Your Honor, and I also would like to direct you to the deposition of the superintendent of the school district. Appellants contend that sheds light upon the district's requirement to follow DOE protocols. It doesn't shed any light on how the DOE protocol was established, but it does state that the district is required to follow the protocols that are established by the department. And I also just wanted to touch upon the in loco parentis doctrine.
Does that mean it's voluntary or not? The other side is saying this wasn't a voluntary assumption of a duty.
Whether it's voluntary or it's mandatory, I mean, there's still a common law duty here in this situation. whether or not it fits within the parameters of Section 323, I mean, that's their contention, that it takes them out of 323. I think there's other reasons to say that there are other restatement sections that support a duty in this situation and other common law doctrines that support a duty. We don't think that there's any sort of, I mean, even if that protocol was mandatory, was it mandatory to hire a behavioral interventionist? They haven't claimed that. There's no evidence that it was mandatory to hire behavioral interventionists. No evidence that they were required to adopt a district protocol that was different from the Department of Education protocol. So in those situations, there are voluntary undertakings.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Aye.